Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Purdy Insurance. Visit Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury or visit online at purdyinsurance.com.
I'll start with an apology because when he was here, I did not go over to say hi to him, and I should have. Mike Golic Jr. Mike, I apologize for that.
No, you know what? It's all good, especially that day. There's a lot going on. There were whiteout conditions there. And going through the press box, when you got all that creamery ice cream up there, we all have our focus in one particular place. So I can understand how we were ships in the night during all that.
Hey, look. At Notre Dame, you had the grotto. Here we got the creamery.
Hey, listen, I can tell you again, love the grotto, have a great time. No one has ever served me that quantity of ice cream during a trip to the grotto. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, only thing I did there was light a candle.
Exactly. Candles and ice cream. Listen, I know they both serve their own purpose.
Yes.
I just like to be able to digest my purpose.
Yes, exactly. So I felt better after each.
Exactly.
How about that? Mike, Mike, with Learfield this year, you did a lot of – you were able to get around the country and see a lot of games during the course of this season. What did that mean to you as a broadcaster that you were actually on the scene to see as many players and as many teams as possible to give you some perspective?
Yeah, I think that's been one of my favorite parts about the job, really, for the last few years. You know, starting in 2020, the pandemic season, I've been calling games, but as part of a floating crew, and then 2020, I was on the Thursday night crew for ESPN, but we were doing that remote. And so I think in the last couple of years, it's been a renewed appreciation to see the work that these, you know, young athletes are doing up close and personal, to get a sense for, you know, the time and place, to get a sense for these campuses and these programs and traditions that, you know, a lot of them I didn't get to play at as a player. I didn't get to play at as an opponent in those environments or go to as a fan growing up. And so to get to one parachute in on the, you know, cultures and traditions that each program and each fan base brings is awesome. But then I think it's just that getting back close to, you know, the thing that I got to do as a player, the life that I got to live, and seeing the many different challenges that a lot of players now face, but also just how similar the work is, how similar that grind is, and trying to make sure that I'm in the best position to tell their story possible.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, because Tom Bowman, of course, you know, running the show, and, of course, he's been running the Learfield show for a long time, and he comes into the booth, and we talk for maybe a half hour, 45 minutes before that game. And he says, you know, Steve, he says, all these years, this is the first time I've been here. He says, I normally only go when there's a problem, which made us feel better because we hadn't been having a problem. So
that is true. Always good news. It's like being an offensive lineman. Life is always better when your name is not getting called, except for a very elite few. Yeah. If your name's getting called, it means you got beat and you jumped offsides. Neither of those are good things. So you didn't get beat, you didn't jump offsides, and so you get passing marks there, which we always love.
Okay, I want to ask you, when you played, who was the toughest grader that you had in terms of grading your performance?
Oh, I mean, it was Harry Hiestand, who was my offensive line coach for my last year in South Bend,
okay. And
who is the offensive line coach there now. And you got to understand, he's the one that was there to groom Zach Martin and Ronnie Stanley and Quentin Nelson and all these guys that were first-round picks at Notre Dame. And he's a tough guy to play for, but you get the benefit of it on the other side of it. But he was by far the toughest grader. I'll never forget, we played Navy in Ireland, the first game of my fifth-year senior year in 2012. And we went out there and we absolutely walked them. I mean, we beat them probably 45-14 or something like that. The game wasn't even close. And we went into that film room as an O-line that next Monday to watch that tape. And we walked out of there, every guy to a man looked like we had seen a ghost. He undressed us because we were below our standard. It didn't matter what the final score was. We didn't go out there and execute. And that was the day that we really learned, all right, we're not playing against the opponent. We're playing against the standard that he is helping set in this room. And when that's the case, it's amazing what you can accomplish.
And the reason I ask that is Jordan Hill, who played here at Penn State, they're playing the last game of the regular season against Wisconsin in 2012, same year as you. Right? And he goes out, and Jack Ham and I feel on the broadcast that he is having a phenomenal game. It's over. He's got like a dozen tackles, the whole thing. So a couple of years ago, I'm talking to him, Mike, and I said, you know, I said how Jack and I, he says, I thought I had a great game too. He says, and Larry Johnson Sr. was the defensive line coach at the time. He says, you know what he graded me out at? I said, I don't know. I said, 70, 80? He goes, 13. I said, 13. That's a tough grade, Mike.
it is, but you know what? And coaches like that, and Larry's certainly in that vein where they've got such a known pedigree for what they produce as far as the guys on the other side. Those are the ones you trust. And great guys like that want to be coached that hard because it's easy for everyone to pat you on the back and say, oh, that's great. We're all looking for ways to get better. And so while it certainly is tough medicine to take in the interim, and when you're 18 to 21 years old, you maybe don't want to hear it as much. But, God, I used to sit with my dad and break down some of my high school games.
Yeah.
And I promise you, as a 16-year-old, I didn't always want to hear the criticisms that my dad had. They made me better on the back end, but it is a tough pill to swallow at the time. That's always true.
Northwest Catholic?
Northwest Catholic, yes, sir. West Hartford's very own.
Yeah, no, because I grew up in Enfield, so.
There we go.
There
you
go. Hey, so I know it. How tough a grader was your dad?
Dad had a little bit better bedside manner. That from someone that works in words, right? Like, he knew, hey, listen, Coach Easton wasn't there with his kid. Coach Easton didn't have to talk to me or talk to my mom after practice. So my dad had to do both of those things. He had to kind of balance that with the tough love and the honesty that you would expect, but also knowing that if it went too far and mom heard about it, all of a sudden he was going to be the one getting chewed out because that's the only grader that matters in his life is mom.
So Chris got you like an extra letter grade.
Yes, oh, exactly. No doubt. We were grading on the mom curve, no doubt.
Perfect. What was the best team you thought you saw this season when you saw
them? Whew. The best team we saw at the time, I would probably say Michigan. You know, yeah. We didn't get a chance to cover Georgia this season,
okay.
But we had Michigan out in the big house for the Michigan-Michigan State game.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That one obviously became a lot about what happened off the field after the game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on the field during the game, and I'd say even, you know, part of that's a holdover. When we were getting ready to cover Penn State the week prior, that was, you know, the week after Penn State and Michigan had played. That obviously went very south very quickly for the Nittany Lions. And so just watching a lot of them in preparation for Penn State, watching them, seeing them up close in the big house against Michigan State, in that game where, quite honestly, I looked and said I thought left some reps on the table of trying to develop that downfield passing game that ended up winning them the game against Ohio State. Those big plays that hadn't really existed all year for J.J. McCarthy and the guys in the passing attack that showed up there. Even with that, they were so physical along the line of scrimmage. Blake Corum, who I had third on my Heisman ballot for the voting that finished up this weekend,
yep.
I thought he was sensational behind one of the best offensive lines in the country. And honestly, for them, replacing what you did on defense with Aiden Hutchinson and David Ajabo and the fact that you were just able to bring in a bunch of new guys and get sack production all over the place that really offset those losses very well was really, really impressive to see.
Yeah, that's the offensive line really strikes me about that. And I thought also the tight end Schoonmaker. I mean, he's to me, you add him in with that. And then you put in the Donovan Edwards kid. When Penn State had played the week before, Mike, and Jack and I were doing the pregame, you know, Corum is a given. All right, so I understand that. We said the key guy to watch for was Donovan Edwards. We regret saying it now.
Yeah, no, everyone watched him. They watched him over and over again keep running. And no, you're right, because he also posed a very different threat, right? Because
yeah.
I think Blake's best attribute is tough and great vision. He sees things happen and unfold. He knows how to set up his blockers really well. He's an O-lineman's best friend.
And Edwards is a better receiver.
Edwards is a better receiver, and he's, you know, a little faster. He's a little more athletic. He's a home run threat.
You bet.
The hole's got to be there for him, though. He's not going to necessarily be able to find it the same way Blake is. But when he hits it, you saw it happen against Penn State. You saw it happen against Ohio State. He's got that capability.
The way McCarthy brought them back against Ohio State, I think that was what people were wondering. Because, I mean, Ohio State's winning the game. What did you see in the growth and maturation of McCarthy, especially in that spot? Because obviously the possibility is going to be there in the same spot with Georgia.
Yeah, I think just the confidence to turn it loose in certain spots when he was under pressure. Ohio State was very physical along the lines of scrimmage. I actually think for a lot of the day, Ohio State won the physical battle up front.
Yeah.
You can say a lot of things about what happened with Jim Knowles' defense for the rest of that day and giving up big plays, but they made a commitment. They said, we're going to put bodies near the line of scrimmage. We're going to let this physical D-line go and pin their ears back the way we've seen under Jim Knowles going back to Oklahoma State. And so it forced J.J. McCarthy against some pressure looks. And you saw that on the very first touchdown to Ronnie Bell. He ends up having to just throw that thing out to a spot where his receiver is, and Bell makes a great play and makes the guy miss for a touchdown. But doing that under pressure, and that's part of why he made the move to McCarthy, right? He's got elite physical tools as far as the arm talent, and he can also buy a little extra time with his legs. And so I thought there were a couple of throws like that under pressure that really showed, quite honestly, things that we hadn't had to see from them all year. And the fact that he was able to muster that up in the most important game of their season was really impressive.
I had to ask you about your alma mater, because they put together that great defensive performance in the opening night. They, you know, we know about the loss to Marshall and so forth. They ended up 8-4. Where do you think Notre Dame is right now?
I think Notre Dame got back on solid footing by the end of the season.
Okay.
I think we saw in college football this year a lot of regime changes, a few first-time head coaches, and a lot of coaches in their first year all have a lot of immediate success because they walked in, and you look, I think, a lot of those situations, right? Sonny Dykes at TCU, Dan Lanning at Oregon, on and on down the list. A lot of places where you walked into a bunch of experience on the offensive line and in some cases the defensive line as well, and veteran quarterbacks. In the case for Notre Dame, they didn't have that. They had a young offensive line, a very talented group that by the end of the season played really well. But you started off the season with young offensive line on the edges and in the middle, and then a quarterback that was inexperienced but talented and then got hurt. So you're on your backup by week two or week three. And that made what Marcus Freeman's job was in coming in and continuing a locker room that had won double-digit games for the last 5 years a lot harder, because the things that you had been able to count on with Ian Book at quarterback for a long time,
right,
and then Jack Cohn, the veteran transfer from Wisconsin, those guardrails weren't there anymore. And so I thought he did a really good job of getting this team's feet back under them, getting them back to the point by the end of the season where they were going out and playing the brand of football we've become accustomed to for Notre Dame in the trenches on both lines of scrimmage. The challenge now for Marcus Freeman, and the reason you made the move for him to begin with, is what happens between now and signing day. Notre Dame has something like the third-ranked class, depending on what rating system you subscribe to, in this 2023 class. That is not the kind of recruiting classes they had been pulling in during the majority of Brian Kelly's tenure. They had recruited good, not great, and they had managed to pull in some great players. Their job now, and the reason you made a move towards a young first-time head coach who is an incredible recruiter, is to try and see if you can now fill the coffers with athletic talent that's a little more on par, a little more often, with the guys at Ohio State, with the guys at Georgia, with the guys at Alabama.
Also, too, a lot of people may not realize, they ended up playing, they're supposed to play five, but I think they only played four ACC games this year. And they won all four by double digits. And that includes the two teams that played in the title game, Clemson and North Carolina. They beat all four by double digits.
I think Notre Dame, since they started this ACC tie-in, has a perfect regular season record against the ACC. I forget when that agreement came in, but I remember their only loss was in 2020 to Clemson in the ACC championship game, so a postseason game. They've acquitted themselves really well against that competition for the crowd that really wants Notre Dame to join a conference.
Right, so that does bring up my next question. The college football playoff goes to 12. Notre Dame, under the current format of 12, cannot get a bye, because only the conference champions, the top four rated conference champions, get a bye. And Jack Swarbrick was on the four-man committee, so I mean he's part of this. At some point, Mike, can Notre Dame continue on the independent road, in your opinion, or at some point do they have to go to a conference? And I don't mean like next year, but I'm talking about 5, 6, 7 years from now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could talk me into inside a decade that happened, because I think that would probably be because we've had another round of realignment. And the one giant super conference that we own, you know, we've already heard people referring to the Big Ten and the SEC as the Power Two now. Like, people kind of see where this is going.
Yeah.
And so if you told me that eventually it did consolidate into something that's more of like a Champions League style, Notre Dame had to join, absolutely, I would buy that that's a possibility right now. I trust, especially with Jack Swarbrick at the helm as athletic director, because like you said, he's in all these rooms. Every time you hear a committee discussion, it is the, you know, conference commissioners and Jack Swarbrick. He's the only one that's got to do both. He's an athletic director, and he's essentially a conference commissioner for the independent conference that is Notre Dame. And so I trust the direction he's going to put this program because he understands what's important. Can we have a competitive television deal and a path to the championship? And right now they've still, it appears, got both of those on the table for an independent. We'll see how the TV deal works out. But right. You just pointed out, yeah, there's no buy. But for Notre Dame, their playoff chances are going to have less to do with getting a buy or not for something like that, and more with what we talked about before,
right, exactly.
Making sure you get a more consistent crop of 4- and 5-star athletes than you've had previously.
Final question, because you did obviously the whiteout game at Beaver Stadium. After the Michigan game, Penn State went 5-1. The only one was the Ohio State game where Penn State had a lead in the fourth quarter of that game. The other five were all blowouts, like the one you witnessed. What was your thought and your thoughts on Penn State?
I mean, a really exciting running back group and a very creative defense. Manny Diaz came over, obviously, after a very, we'll say, interesting breakup with Miami.
Yeah.
And I thought acquitted himself really well. Outside of, like you said, you know, the Michigan game was really the one game where that defense got gashed in a big way. But what they were able to do there with some NFL talent that we know won't be on the field for the bowl game. Joey Porter Jr. is going to be getting ready for the draft instead of being in the Rose Bowl. But I thought that defense really gave opposing offenses a lot to handle. You have a lot of those simulated pressures that have become popular in a world where Dave Aranda has become one of the big defensive masterminds in college football. And then offensively, you know, Sean Clifford has kind of been the same that Sean Clifford we've always seen, right?
Yeah.
There's been a bunch of good, there's been a bunch of bad. A lot of people wanted to see Alar get some time in there. But when you've got a backfield with, you know, Allen and Singleton that you could rely on more often than not in that offense, it created a really steady foundation that you can win with in college football. Like that formula of consistent defense, a ground game that's got some special players, and a veteran quarterback who more often than not is going to have you in the right position, even if he lacks maybe some of that top-end ability to make truly extraordinary plays, you can win a lot of games. It's like you said, when you bump up against the Michigans and Ohio States of the world, that you're going to run into some problems until you maybe start to address that quarterback position in a different way and get a little bit more consistent across the offensive line of scrimmage.
Mike, always a pleasure. Always enjoy talking to you. Just you're great, and we appreciate it a lot.
Absolutely. We'll make sure next time that I am out there in Happy Valley, we meet up, ice cream instead of just enjoying it and passing.
In fact, you know what? The heck with it. Let's just get a half gallon and go from there.
See, now you're speaking my language. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks, Mike.